Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Clearly, this is not a market that's too concerned about a government shutdown, at least not yet. It's not an economic event unless it goes on for a bit longer, although the missing jobs report on Friday will leave a huge question mark hanging over the Friday trade as we make our way forward here. It's day one. They're voting again, as we mentioned, on the two CRs today in the Senate, with everybody asking the same question. Why don't we let the Republican leader in the Senate take it from here?
Everybody's now asking the question, how does this end? Well, it ends when the Senate Democrats pick this bill up, passed by the House of Representatives, and vote for it. It's on the floor of the Senate. We're going to vote later this morning on this, 24 pages.
This is where we start our conversation on Capitol Hill. Bloomberg Government's Jack Fitzpatrick is standing by, our appropriations expert. Jack, what is the answer to that question? How long could this go?
This will be a test of members' patience with their leadership and how long rank and file members, especially in the Senate, just want to leave all the power in the hands of John Thune, the Speaker of the House, of the President of the United States. Right now, there are not significant back channels. There's not a gang forming of centrist members who want to take the reins and say, put me in charge. I'm going to find an alternate path forward. But that is one of the significant X factors here. I spoke to Jeanne Shaheen, a more moderate Democrat from New Hampshire, who said there are member-to-member conversations on the Affordable Care Act subsidies. There are conversations happening. But right now, largely, this is all being left to the principals, the big four congressional leaders and the president. And there's enough patience from senators to see if one side breaks, to allow their leaders to try to negotiate and use pressure tactics, so that right now there's not a lot of movement. There's not an alternate path coming forward. It's the Republicans seeing if the Democrats will break and the Democrats seeing if the Republicans will break.
Jack, can you just set up the rest of today for us? What is on the docket when it comes to procedure in the upper chamber?
Right now, not much is left. They just did their two votes that we saw coming. This is the third failed vote on both the Democratic proposal to fund the government and the Republican proposal to fund the government. The Democratic one failed along party lines. The Republican proposal was the same as last night. It was 55 to 45, short of the 60 votes necessary. You got three Democrats who signed on. So we're still watching those three Democrats, Fetterman, Cortez Masto, and King, the independent who caucuses with the Democrats. That shows there's no movement. And so it is going to be a test of patience and a test of willpower, because nobody broke. And we've now had three votes on the same exact proposals that haven't gotten to that 60-vote threshold. After that, they're set to leave town for Yom Kippur. They could announce emergency votes if necessary, but there's not a lot going on, and there's not even real negotiating happening today.
All right. Bloomberg Government's Jack Fitzpatrick, we thank you as always for your reporting and insight live for us from Capitol Hill. And we mentioned this at the top of the show. We are hearing from both sides of the aisle, congressional leadership on the messaging around the shutdown. We did hear from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today giving this message to his members.
He is using the American people as pawns, threatening pain on the country as blackmail. Well, that's not going to work. The American people, it's so easy to see through those tactics. They know this is the Trump shutdown. They know Republicans control the presidency, the Senate, and the House. And what is done during a shutdown will fall squarely on the Republicans' back.
To dive into the politics and the policy, we're joined now by Republican Senator Ted Budd of North Carolina. Senator, thanks so much for joining Bloomberg. Let's just start with the latest. What are you hearing behind closed doors about where this shutdown is heading? Is there any sort of development that you can give us when it comes to the negotiations?
There's really no clear over-under on this. Is it going to be short? Is it going to be long? It's really up to Chuck Schumer. He's the one that needs to negotiate with himself, maybe negotiate with AOC, because it really seems that it's New York City and New York State politics that are playing out on a national stage right now. Chuck Schumer isn't concerned about America. He's not concerned about government employees. He's not really concerned about the rest of our country. He's only concerned about having a primary in for U.S. Senator from AOC. So he has to show his radical base that he's actually fighting. What he really wants to do is spend $1.5 trillion more. He wants to give health care to illegals. He wants to undo the working families tax cut. And he wants to hurt rural hospitals, and he wants to continue these COVID handouts. That's what he's trying to do, and it's really just about appeasing his radical base.
I just want to understand if you can explain to us the idea of giving health care to illegals. Isn't it impossible for an undocumented citizen to be eligible for health care?
The way they were, thank you for asking, the way they were enrolled, it actually would lead to them through other avenues being into these entitlement programs. So would we send a check directly? No, but were they enrolled through other measures? Absolutely. And those that were here legally, of course, and those that were citizens, sometimes it was couples up to making up to $500,000 were getting these subsidies. So do we need to fix these reform or have some reforms in regards to these subsidies? Yes, there are some people that actually need them. There's some contractors, some blue collar folks that were on 1099s and they need to have them, but we need to reform them. We don't want to throw them out. We want to say, let's have the discussion. But this is completely nonsensical what Chuck Schumer's doing. He's saying you have to do this right now or we're going to shut the government down. And matter of fact, he did it at midnight last night. This is a December discussion. This is not a late September or an early October discussion. This is something we can keep working on. You can shut the government down and have a discussion, which he did, which is very expensive, and he's been opposed to it up till now. Or
well,
you can keep
Democrats
it open and have discussions.
Are saying about that. I was in the Senate in that same spot you're standing and talking with a number of your colleagues, Schmidt, Marshall, and others last evening. Tom Cole joined us. And the idea here about where we're going has just raised a whole bunch of questions. Chuck Schumer was talking about this earlier today on the Senate floor. When we
well, I've, look, I've heard lots of comments from him.
Well, let me just ask you this question, Senator. Yeah. We'll put Chuck Schumer aside for a moment. You're saying that extending the Obamacare subsidies is a matter for the end of the year. But a number of Democrats who've joined us, Chris Coons last evening, said notices are going out and open enrollment is about to begin, that health care premiums actually start rising today. Are they wrong?
I think they're wrong in their timing. This is something we need to discuss, but you don't do it in an emergency fashion like this. The reason that you do a stopgap continuing resolution or CR is so that you can have these conversations and let the appropriations committee, with people that are elected to do so and are put on these committees to do so, can work out the budgets in a reasonable means. That's the regular order that we talk about here, and that's what we need to do. This is right now, this argument, this shutdown, it's very expensive. It doesn't make any sense. It backs Chuck Schumer further into a corner. I think it only gets worse for him, not better. We're the reasonable ones here. Donald Trump is reasonable. But it's completely just trying to appease Chuck Schumer's radical base is all he's doing, and showing that he's having a fight so he doesn't have a primary from AOC.
Well, Senator, you're saying that shutdowns are expensive, so I'd love your take on the White House's threat when it comes to permanent layoffs. It's our understanding that the OMB director, Russ Vogt, will be speaking to your colleagues on the House side today about that potential. We should say at this point it doesn't appear that agencies have laid out that plan, but do you agree with this as a negotiating tactic?
I don't think it's about a negotiating tactic, but if Chuck Schumer is going to hand this card to the White House, which wants to be fiscally responsible, I mean, that's one of the reasons that President Trump was elected, is to get the fiscal house of America back in order. And there are a lot of people that are needed in the private sector. There's a lot of talent that work for the U.S. government that may be better serving our economy working in the private sector and not at the behest of American taxpayers. And if it's a chance for Russ Vogt to right the ship on that, then so be it. Yeah, I mean, it's not about being mean, it's about being fiscally responsible for American taxpayers.
Well, what do you think he can do here? If the government shut down, he's got the keys to the kingdom, Senator. How many workers do you think Russ Vogt can cut?
look, I don't know. He's going to look at this, and you have to keep the funk. I think people want the American government to work. They want it to open. They want it to be responsible. They want, don't want it to be front and center. I mean, people want to go home. They want to talk about their lives. They want to live their lives. And you just need the American government to work. And Chuck Schumer has thrown it into dysfunction. He's overspending. He's trying to add $1.5 trillion, much of that for illegals. And I think Americans think that's ridiculous. Look, if somebody is not essential right now, then they don't need to be working for the American government. And I think that's what Russ Vought's going to look at. He's going to do the right thing.
Senator, I do want to ask you about another policy that has really come to the forefront this week, and that's President Trump's policies regarding tariffs. We saw him renew tariffs when it comes to the furniture industry. In particular, in his post announcing on it on Truth Social, he highlighted your state of North Carolina. Now, we've seen some mixed reviews from domestic industry. I'm wondering where you stand on this policy and what you're hearing from domestic furniture makers about this more protectionist view.
Well, President Trump and I have the same goal, and that is to reindustrialize the United States. So I think that is what he's for. He wants more manufacturing to be done here. You know, we've seen some post-NAFTA revitalization of the North Carolina furniture industry, but it's still not where it was pre-NAFTA. So we want more industry to come back here. I'm not traditionally a fan of tariffs, but I am a fan of what Donald Trump's trying to do, and that is level the playing field against countries that have cheated us and have taken our workforce away and have hurt American employment and have hurt our industries over the last 20 or 30 years. So I think he's trying to right the ship and attract these countries to reinvest and these companies to reinvest in North Carolina and the other great states in our country. And it's starting to happen. I wish it would have happened yesterday. I wish it would have happened years ago. I wish we would have never had the disjointed economic effect that NAFTA did on North Carolina. But those decisions are behind us. Now let's get America back on track, especially our economy.
Really glad you could join us, Senator. And what's happening in North Carolina is important to us, so we'd love to have you back. Senator Ted Budd, the Republican from North Carolina, making his debut on Bloomberg TV and radio in the throes of a government shutdown. Thank you for joining us here on the Wednesday edition. We're not even 24 hours into this shutdown, and we have a lot of questions still about what took place last evening. Already again today, we've seen the two continuing resolutions, Republican and Democratic versions, fail, and there is no one talking, and there appear to be no off-ramps at the moment. You just heard the Republican take on this. Let's hear from a Democrat in Glen Ivey. The congressman from Maryland is with us in studio here in Washington. Welcoming you back, sir. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been through a couple of these, but I have to admit, I know everyone says this time is different, and it kind of feels a little different this time with Russ Vought circling over the Capitol.
Well, I think the big differences are sort of twofold. One is the threat that the president made to punitively terminate government employees, which is illegal, as you just heard in the previous segment. And there's a lawsuit about that. The second, though, is I think the widespread pushback. So the Trump shutdown in 2018 was about building the wall. Most Americans really didn't care one way or the other about that. When they get these notices in their mailbox that their premium's about to double for their health care insurance, they're going to care about that. And they won't care what the spin is from Washington. They won't care what the process was. They won't care what Chuck Schumer said or whoever. They'll want to find out how to get their premiums back down, and I mean yesterday. And that's when this is going to move. That'll light a fire under the Republicans to get something done on that front.
Just on the first point about potential layoffs, you represent a district that has a lot of federal workers.
Absolutely.
Are you hearing concerns from constituents leading up to this and now that the shutdown has actually started?
Well, I started hearing concerns from my constituents from January 20th, because that's as soon as Donald Trump hit the door, he started firing government employees, and he couldn't do it fast enough for his taste. And we filed multiple lawsuits, Democracy Forward and the unions, to show that, to slow that down and address it, make sure people were getting fair treatment. Mm-hmm. But you know, now they've hit the saturation point for sure. They're actually starting to bring some people back that they'd forced out previously, mm-hmm. because they need enough people to do the services. And there's some services that are like clinical trials for Alzheimer's research that I just thought it was crazy that they shut that down. It's indefensible, frankly. So I think they're going to turn the corner on that, hopefully, based on the pushback they're getting from within their own party and from the American people. And I think that's going to make it hard for them to follow up on this threat that they made. But you never know with those guys. You really can't tell.
Republicans remind us that these are COVID-era Obamacare subsidies. And many ask, why they should still be around since the pandemic is not. What's the real answer on this? Should there be a permanent extension? Does it imply that Obamacare is not working as designed? Or should there be new rules, new guardrails about how this works?
I think there should be a permanent extension. They didn't have any trouble doing a permanent extension for their 27 tax cuts for the people that you know, the billionaires and the really wealthy people that benefit from it. Why can't they do a permanent extension that helps regular Americans maintain health care? You know, Donald Trump and many of these Republicans have been out to get Obamacare for 15 years now, and they found that they couldn't do it after the first 2 years because once people got it and realized how valuable it was and critical to their health care coverage, it became bulletproof. This is a kind of a Trojan horse approach to taking it down. You could have millions of people that lose their coverage based on what they're doing here, and they really aren't giving any good explanation for why they won't do it.
Just for clarity, would you support a commitment to negotiations down the road, or do you want to see pen and paper, pen put to paper before the government is reopened when it comes to this?
Two problems with down the road. One is we've been negotiating this for months now. Mm-hmm. For example, the $1 trillion in Medicaid tax cuts, that was an H.R. 1. Democrats fought against that. Almost all of us voted against it in the House. They passed it anyway on a party line vote. On the subsidy extensions, I'm on the Appropriations Committee. We tried multiple times to put in amendments on the appropriations bills that would have given the extension at that point. Mm-hmm. They voted them down every time by unanimous party line vote by the Republicans. So they can't say we need 7 more weeks to figure this out because we've had 7 months to be working on this and have been. So my sense of this is, they've been voting to kill it over and over again. Why should we assume that they're changing their minds now? Why should we credit that statement? And of course, Donald Trump has been totally erratic and unreliable on commitments that have been made one way or the other. So, yeah, I'd like to see it in writing. Matter of fact, I'd like to see it get done now as part of reopening the government. We can do both at once. They really haven't given a good explanation as to, like, oh, it's part regular order and all this. Regular order didn't work. So now we're trying this now to make sure the American people, I think there's 15, 16 million of them that could lose their coverage. Yeah, we want to make sure they get their coverage.
Well, we all remember, of course, the shutdown in 2013 that was surrounding Obamacare. We've been going around the block on this for a while here. I'm curious to hear from you. What happens in a congressional office when the government closes? You had to probably meet with your staff. At least last time you were all in a room to let them know they were not going to be getting paid starting today. Does the office close? What happens?
No, we keep going. In fact, we've got a call tonight. It's a town hall webinar where people who are, you know, facing these issues, the layoffs and the like, and have questions can call in. Ivy.house.gov, or not call in, but tune in. It's a webinar streaming to try and get information. Other congressional offices are doing similar types of things. Obviously, we're going to keep working in the community to try and help with people trying to figure out how to get
through this. Is that a motivator when lawmakers see that the staff isn't buying lunch or coming to work or getting a second job? I mean, that's real, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm a former staffer, so I know you know how hard it can be on them. I'm also a former federal government employee of the Department of Justice, for example. Yeah. So I know the impacts can be really tough on folks. Most folks need their payment. They need their income to stay steady. Mm-hmm. They're living paycheck to paycheck, so it's tough on them. But at least in my district so far, people seem to understand the importance of this moment, the need to make sure that health care gets extended. Because many of them, yes, they're government employees, but they, you know, grandma's in a nursing home based on them getting the payments through Medicaid. They understand the fallout of what could happen here.
We are talking about the fiscal impacts, and I'm wondering what you make of Republicans' recent argument that the Democratic-backed plan could add $1.5 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. That's according to an estimate from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
It's kind of laughable because the tax cuts that they put in place in H.R. 1 is like between $4 and $5 trillion. So, you know, I hear them start complaining about the deficit again, and I'm like, where were you when you passed this thing unanimously, essentially? So here's the issue. They're trying to do a lot for the billionaire buddies. Can they do something for the American people, regular folks in the working class? They're not trying to ask for a whole lot of handouts or anything, but they do want to have, just give them the chance to extend their health care coverage with the subsidies that they've been given and come to rely on. Give them a chance to continue to get the Medicaid funding that they need for, you know, elderly and the disabled and children who are poor and the like. Why are we cutting that stuff to give, like, you know, tax cuts for people who really don't need the money? And many of them aren't even asking for it. So it's inexplicable to me and indefensible, frankly.
I don't know how much time you spent on Truth Social, but you might have seen the videos the president's been posting about your leader in the House, Hakeem Jeffries. There was one a couple of days ago. He's standing side by side Chuck Schumer. It's an AI-generated deep fake where Chuck Schumer is saying offensive things about undocumented immigrants. And the Democratic leader in the House is put in some sort of mariachi outfit in what was deemed a sure-to-offend racial depiction of Jeffries. And he did it again last night.
Yeah, I mean,
what does that tell you about the willingness to compromise?
I mean, it tells me more than that. I mean, you start kind of wondering if the guy's really stable or not. I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. The performance in front of the generals and admirals yesterday was unsettling, too, to say the least. And there's been a whole string of that with this guy since he got back into the White House. I mean, if Joe Biden had been doing stuff like this, you know, you'd have to peel people off the walls. Oh, he's lost it. And, you know, let's, you know, measure Trump by the same yardstick.
It's good to have you back.
Good to be back.
Maybe when things reopen, we'll talk again. Unless this goes on for a while. Congressman Glenn Ivey, the Democrat from Maryland.
Apparently, I'll have some free time.
It sounds like it. Thank you for being here.
All right.
For all the wrong reasons, but we'll keep in touch on this one.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're glad you joined us here on the Wednesday edition. I'm Joe Matthew alongside Tyler Kendall in Washington. We're going to have a conversation straight ahead with Congresswoman Lisa McClain, important as she is chair of the House Republican Conference and will bring us inside the negotiations or lack thereof at the moment. We spoke as well today with Larry Summers, my colleague David Weston at Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York, speaking with the former Treasury Secretary about this government shutdown. Here's what Summers said.
This is about whether we should be scaling back the availability of health insurance for millions of Americans who in the old system used to not have eligibility for coverage, and in the new system do have eligibility for coverage. And people should make their choice about what they think. And I suspect that will become clearer in the days, perhaps the weeks ahead, and we will see how it all plays out. But people shouldn't be distracted by the budget resolutions and the supermajorities and the 60 votes in the Senate and the appropriations process or any of that. This is a stark question. The government can reopen tomorrow if the president of the United States is prepared to accept the maintenance of Medicaid benefits, is prepared to accept the continuing functioning of the exchanges that have brought health insurance to millions of Americans, most of whom are employed by small businesses who can't really manage to provide health insurance to all their workers.
That's the take from Larry Summers earlier today on Bloomberg. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Congresswoman Lisa McClain. She's live on Capitol Hill, chair of the House Republican Conference, representing the 9th District of Michigan. Congresswoman, it's good to see you. Welcome back. And I guess I should say happy shutdown day, or there's probably not much happy about it considering what's going on here. I know that this is a Senate matter right now, and they're going to keep voting on the continuing resolutions that we have seen. But I guess the big question today is how long this might last. What are you hearing behind the scenes?
You know, I can share with you from the Republican standpoint, we hope it doesn't last very long because we don't want the American people to feel the pain from the Democratic shutdown. So I really don't have a sense of that because it's not in our hands. It's in the Democrats' hands right now.
Congresswoman, our understanding is the OMB director, Russ Vogt, was set to speak to your conference today. Can you confirm, has that call already happened, and what was discussed, including the future of potential permanent layoffs?
I left the call early to come to the interview, so we did have the call, and he was explaining kind of the process on how things work if this government shutdown continues. He stressed again that he hopes that it doesn't continue, that the president and the administration don't have to make the tough calls, but at the end of the day, there's only so much money to go around, and it is, you know, Mr. Vogt's job as well as the administration's job to figure out who is essential and how to continue the programs that are essential. But he wanted to stress again that this can all be avoided if the Democrats come to the table like they have under Chuck Schumer 13 times before and vote for the exact same CR that they voted for in March.
We spoke earlier this hour, Congresswoman, with Senator Ted Budd, the Republican from North Carolina, who made the point that if employees, federal employees, are deemed non-essential at this time, then maybe they shouldn't be working for the government to begin with. Should those 750,000 furloughs today be layoffs?
You know, I think it's a really hard question really to answer. And I say that because I think if that happens, and again, I hope it doesn't happen as a Republican, I hope it doesn't happen. But we know that the government is bloated, right? I think if this does happen, it's going to uncover a lot of what's going on in terms of who is essential and who really isn't essential. If I'm a furloughed employee right now, I don't know that I'd really want to have the government shut down right now.
And Congresswoman, I do want to keep with the labor market, pull on your expertise, your perch on House Fin Services, because our understanding is the BLS isn't going to release the jobs report this Friday, of course, considered to be one of the leading indicators of the health of the labor market. Are there any discussions when you are hearing from the OMB about what is essential and what is not, that data collection could actually fall into that bucket if this shutdown continues?
Yeah, you're right. Everything is on the table, and it's a really tough job to be in with that Russ has to do, is how do we make good decisions, right? Data is always important in making decisions. So again, I don't really understand why the Democrats want this shutdown to put more and more power in the administration's hands, right? They've railed against the administration, in my opinion, unrightly so, for doing what the American people elected them to do, and that is be fiscally responsible. They right now are ceding all of the power to the administration. I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me. But, you know, as Republicans, we want to open the government. We want to get back to business, to doing our business. I would add this. As Republicans, we've passed all 12 appropriation bills out of committee. We are getting back to how business is supposed to be done in D.C., right? That's what the people want. They want something different. They don't want this big omnibus, right? They want us to go through the appropriations process. That's what we're doing right now, but it's really tough to do that when the government's shut down.
Congresswoman, would you be willing to promise your Democratic colleagues to have an actual negotiation and debate over the extension of Obamacare subsidies if the government is reopened? Or has that overture already been made?
No, we have to have that discussion. We have to have that negotiation. We have to have that debate, right? And that's what we're willing to do. But the issue is we have a funding issue right now. This isn't a healthcare issue. It's not an agriculture issue. It's not a transportation and infrastructure issue. It is a funding issue. The ACA credits don't expire till the end of the year. We have plenty of time to debate and talk about that, which is exactly what we should do, not attach it and cram it down the throats of the American people.
But Congresswoman, just for clarity, do you support any extension to the expiring ACA premium tax credits?
What I support is going through regular order and having debates and discussions. That is how government is supposed to work. We are supposed to work for the American people, and that's what Republicans are doing right now by continuing to want to keep the government open.
Well, there are a lot of questions about how that's going to take place. Democrats tell us that notifications start going out today to those folks, and that premiums are, in fact, already rising. What are you hearing about the cost of health care in Michigan?
Yeah. Listen, the cost of health care is extremely important, and that's why I applaud President Trump. He told you on the campaign trail that he was going to bring drug prices down. And what did he do yesterday? He brought drug prices down. So I applaud President Trump for doing that. He's actually not talking about it and not using it as leverage. He's actually delivering for the American people. What the people in my district are also telling me is they are tired of the waste, the fraud, the abuse that is happening in this healthcare situation right now, and that has got to be eliminated. That's exactly what Republicans did through the working families tax cuts, and that's what we are going to continue to do. Let's get rid of the waste, the fraud, the abuse, to make sure that the healthcare programs that we do have actually work for the American people.
In the final minute we have you, Congresswoman, we did hear Democratic leaders repeatedly say that the ultimate decider here is going to be President Trump. Is that the right assessment? Is the White House fully leading these negotiations?
Well, right now, President Trump is our commander in chief, right? And the Republicans, we have been in constant contact as House Republicans with the White House, with President Trump, on keeping the government open. The president wants to keep the government open. We want to keep the government open. The only people right now that are standing in the way are the Democrats. So we've been in constant communication and constant contact. We're ready to go.
All right. Republican Congresswoman Lisa McClain, she's the chairwoman of the House Republican Conference and represents Michigan's 9th District. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition. If you're just joining us, of Balance of Power. Yeah, it's only Wednesday. Seemed like yesterday was a couple of days in one. But it is the first day of the shutdown. Here we are. We saw it coming literally months ago. In fact, started talking about this back in March, the last time Chuck Schumer, quote unquote, caved and was shamed by many progressives. The seeds were planted for this moment many months ago. The question is, how do we get out of it? Where are the off-ramps, if they exist? Remembering, of course, and we just talked about this with Jonathan Tamari, the first Trump administration saw a record shutdown. That was 35 days, but that was a so-called partial shutdown. And there were some other outside factors that led that to happen. Terry Haynes at Pangea Policy, who we follow very closely here in Washington, in his latest note to clients, unpacks the whole thing. Five reasons why this shutdown very likely won't last long. Leave it to Terry to find the silver linings here. Number one, Schumer's Senate group already is not unified and is fraying. Remember, we got three last night and voted along with this. Two, pressure will continue to build on Senate Democrats as the fate of public employees rapidly concentrates their minds, thanks to Trump's threats to terminate many of them. Remember, 750,000 furloughs today could become layoffs. Three, D's are susceptible to pressure on government data. Oh, that's right, the BLS. Not kicking out the jobs report on Friday. Markets nervous. Four, once the Democrats' resistance political point is made the next days for the party's respective voter bases, major donors, pressure points today signal a resolution to allow negotiations on Obamacare premiums. And five, remember, continuing government funding at current levels is in itself a Democratic win. We'll see about that. Because they're counting the days right now at the Pentagon. And if you think that we're going to be able to pay our troops indefinitely here,
You might be disappointed with what we're about to hear from Arnold Pinaro. The retired Marine Corps general is with us now, former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, with his view on what's happening here in a world of perpetual CRs and now a shutdown. General, it's great to have you back. I saw the statement that you kicked out earlier this week, and you're concerned with readiness. We've had a lot of politicians on last couple of days, and everybody's playing a blame game right now. But I want to get to the matter at hand with you, because you're talking about troops deployed in harm's way do not receive their pay. Civilians performing critical defense functions are furloughed or required, again, to work without compensation. And importantly, we never think about this or talk about it, at least the small businesses that sustain our defense industrial base face immediate financial strain. How long can this go on, General, before it does impact our readiness?
Well, Joe, it's impacting our readiness right now today. There's nothing positive about a government shutdown, particularly as it relates to national security, especially when there's no clear path to a resolution, as Jonathan clearly outlined, and it was totally avoidable. The troops in harm's way, many of them in very dangerous places. We live in a world more dangerous and uncertain than the peak of the Cold War. They're not being paid in their families, just like average Americans. They need their paychecks. We've already sent home over 300,000 defense civilians on furlough as part of that larger number. A number of tens of thousands are having to remain on the job for safety and security, but they aren't being paid either. Cutting edge equipment that's coming off our production lines that need to go to the hands of our warfighters are being parked in the parking lots because the defense civilians that have to be there to accept them on behalf of the government aren't working. And again, the more important thing, small businesses that are the backbone of our supply chain. They're the backbone of the supply chain. If you're building a manned fighter or a submarine or just about any other thing, they are being sent home and shuttered in many, and they will never get back pay, unlike the troops and the civilians, right, if the government ever reopens. But the small businesses, many of them will be put out of business. Necessary training. We the fathers and mothers give us their sons and daughters to serve in the military, expecting them to be well-led, well-equipped, and well-trained. Well, we're not doing the training right now, and you have to do constant and realistic training in the world that we live in. And frankly, the sad thing about this, it was totally unavoidable. We've started the last 25 years with a continuing resolution in the first quarter to give the Congress more time to work out compromises. I really feel like the Democratic leadership has picked the wrong fight. They're shooting on the wrong target, and their bullets are hurting real people just to send a message to their base. Very unfortunate. It is hurting military readiness today.
I was in the Senate last evening, General. I was talking with Senator Eric Schmidt about the fact that troops in harm's way, men and women in uniform, would not be getting paid. And he stopped me in my tracks and said, we're working on something here to tap the $150 billion, I think it was, that was in the president's big, beautiful bill to try to cover their paychecks in the meantime. You're pointing out that that money has a very different and very important purpose.
Look, I'm for the troops getting paid, and as a commanding general of a Marine division, when my troops weren't being paid, I raised unshirted cane. But that reconciliation bill is for modernization and investment. If you start spending it on payroll, you're going to blow a lot of money. Our defense payrolls for our military and our civilians are quite large, and that is not the purpose of what was put in the reconciliation. God bless him, Navy SEAL. And his thinking, but that is not the purpose of that money, and it should not be used for that. Furthermore, it takes all the pressure off of the Democratic leadership if all of a sudden there's no harm being done. I hate to say it that way, but that's just the cold, hard facts of life. We need the Golden Dome. We need to, you know, modernize our Navy. We need to modernize. The Air Force has the oldest fighters and fewer fighters than we've ever had. The Army is 50% smaller than the peak of the Cold War. That money is designed for modernization investment, not for payrolls.
What happens to procurement in a time like this? Is that a longer-term process with monies allocated so it's not impacted by a shutdown, or is this at risk as well?
Well, it's up to the individual contracts. Typically, the Department of Defense does not like to shut down the big production lines because it would be so expensive and so hard to start them back up again, and many of them are funded. And so if there's a contract that's funded, if OMB allows it, they have the discretion to continue that. So typically, they have not shut down the big production lines. But unfortunately, like I mentioned, they shut down the small businesses that are the heart and soul. the small businesses that do forgings and castings. You can't build a fighter without forgings and castings. So even though maybe the big production line of one of the large primes can continue, it's not necessarily true that the small business supply chain is going to be there when they need the part.
Well, that gets back to what you said about these small businesses that sustain the defense industrial base. People are familiar with the Lockheeds and the RTXs and the Northrop Grumman's general. How small are some of these businesses, and what services do they provide?
Well, there are two kinds. They provide a lot of the equipment and specialty technical equipment, microelectronics, things that go into our large production platforms at the big primes. The big primes can manage cash flow. Small businesses don't have spare cash. They can't keep people on the payroll when they're not being paid. And so they either have to send them home on administrative leave. But tens of thousands of small businesses, both in terms of services to the Department of Defense, running the call centers, running the health business, running the IT services, doing the kind of equipment, building the equipment that we need in our supply chain. If you look at some of the major backlogs that we have on our large items of equipment, it's basically because the small businesses in the supply chain have not been able to keep up with demand. Mm-hmm. This is just going to make it a lot worse. And again, these companies never get repaid. So this is not an issue where, okay, we're going to open the government back up and we're going to send them all that back pay. There is no back pay when they don't do the work. The government worker and the military, sooner or later, those that are allowed to come back on the civilian side, like you said, many could be laid off under this circumstance because they want to reduce the size of government. But the small businesses never get paid.
Well, that's right. And boy, that goes for a lot of them around here related to the defense industry and otherwise. General, if you live in Washington, D.C., this is a big time local economic story for a lot of small business owners. I want to ask you, General, because I don't always get a chance to talk with you about what happened yesterday at Quantico. And I suspect that you were watching pretty closely at a very important point of geography for the Marine Corps, Officer Training School. And Pete Hegseth,
what almost looked like
a TED Talk, General.
I got back from Vietnam, was stationed at Quantico, training second lieutenants going to Vietnam.
I'm sure that's right.
I call what happened yesterday a fairly traditional thing we call commander's intent. When I took over the commanding general of 4th Marine Division, I called in all my regimental commanders, battalion commanders, senior enlisted, got them all in one room at one time and said, okay, this is what we need to do in the 4th Division. We need to increase the warfighting readiness of the division. That's going to be our mission. Here's how you're going to do it. So it's called commander's intent. So it didn't bother me that the top civilian leader in the Pentagon would call them in to make sure they basically get everybody on the same sheet of music. And I'll be honest,
what'd you think of his tone and his message?
I had the same reaction as Senator Dan Sullivan, a fellow Marine. The standards of rigorous physical training, appearance, proficiency in your military skills, realistic and tough training, these are in the DNA of the United States Marine Corps. So I didn't find anything, you know, to be concerned about in that area.
I think it was the tone, the idea of the young man walking in and telling the elders with more experience how to do their jobs. Did you appreciate the way the message was delivered?
You know, I'm not an expert on that, but look, we have civilian control of the military. We have elections in this country. The two top civilians in the chain of command to the warfighting commands is a legislation that I helped write in 1986 when we reformed Goldwater-Nichols laws. And so basically, if it's a legal order, you know, our military understands that they're going to follow the legal orders of the chain of command. Yeah. And so, you know, we've had a lot of different people serve as Secretary of Defense over the years. We've had a lot of people serve in the White House over the years. And so our military gets used to different personalities. So, you know, I'm not going to comment on the tone. I think we need to focus on the 10 directives. And frankly, I didn't have a lot that I was concerned about in any of the things that he rolled out. We should make promotions strictly on the merits. We need people to basically be able to be proficient in their military occupational skills. All of those things have been fundamental to the department, now the Department of the War, they call it, you know, for all the years that I served in uniform. So to me, I think it was very appropriate to make sure get everybody on the same sheet.
Well, as I said yesterday, General, I need to start doing my sit-ups or I'm not going to make it. It's great to have you back. Arnold Pinaro, retired two-star Marine Corps Major General, with us here on Balance of Power. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.